The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at hollywoodblends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's special guest is a member of Hollywood royalty. She's the youngest child of the most beloved vocalist and entertainer of all time, Frank Sinatra. As an actress, she appeared in a number of TV shows, including Romeo and Juliet 70, It Takes a Thief, Adam 12, Mannix, and Fantasy Island, but she has devoted most of her life and career to managing, advancing, and honoring the spectacular legacy and body of work of her father's monumental career. She was the executive producer of the fabulous star-studded TV special Sinatra 75, The Best Is Yet to Come, celebrating her father's 75th birthday. She also executive produced the highly acclaimed miniseries Sinatra, which was nominated for 9 Emmy Awards and won 2, in addition to winning a Golden Globe Award for Best Television Miniseries. And she served as executive producer on the TV movie Young at Heart, and was a producer of the 2004 remake of the movie The Manchurian Candidate. In addition, our guest has been instrumental in a number of initiatives and projects which have kept Frank Sinatra's historic contribution to pop culture relevant and current, such as establishing the Frank Sinatra Hall at the USC campus, arranging for her father's film, TV, and audio tape collection to be donated to the UCLA archives, and orchestrating a terrific Grammy Museum exhibit called Sinatra, an American Icon, which toured across America. She's been involved in bringing us wonderful multimedia concert productions at Radio City Music Hall and the London Palladium, as well as the Twyla Tharp dance extravaganza Come Fly Away, which had hugely successful runs on Broadway and in Las Vegas. In her role as senior board member of Frank Sinatra Enterprises, which manages the licensing and usage of her father's name, likeness, recordings, and films, she's been a tremendous support in the creation of the Emmy-nominated two-part HBO documentary, Sinatra, All or Nothing at All. She was instrumental in the launch of the immensely popular Seriously Sinatra channel, which is Channel 70 on Sirius XM, as well as the iconic Sinatra Bar and Lounge in Nashville, and the exciting new show, Sinatra the Musical, which made its world premiere last year in England. And if all of that weren't enough, she wrote a highly compelling, insightful, and poignant memoir, a New York Times best-selling book entitled My Father's Daughter, A Memoir, which was revised in 2015 to commemorate the 100th birthday of her father. I'm delighted and honored to welcome Miss Tina Sinatra to our show. Tina, thank you so much for being here.
Harvey, I'm so impressed with myself. I hardly know what to say. I bless you and thank you for all of that wonderful information, some of which I hoped had been buried like a doggy bone, but I guess not.
No, and there's nothing worth burying. I have to start by telling you that of all the books out there about your dad, I found yours to be the most emotionally heart-wrenching because you took us behind the scenes. You let us get to know not only Frank Sinatra, the brilliant entertainer, and Sinatra, the family man, but also Frank Sinatra, the somewhat tormented human being. Tell us what inspired you to write that book.
Well, I thought that someone closer inside should do something. And I quite honestly, I've never said this publicly, I priced myself so high that I thought it would go away because it was a dichotomy within myself. Do I do it? Do I not? I fumbled with it for quite a while, but David Rosenthal and Michael Korda, then both at Simon & Schuster, said, "You're nuts if you don't do this," because they knew so much of what I had to tell. And the people say, "I'm glad I did it. It was cathartic." And it really was. It was really good to spill a lot of it out, because there was a great deal of inside pressure that came from, I call them the interlopers. You know, it got complicated. I can talk about it as much as you want, but it comes out all right, because we all were a tighter and stronger family, which I think is quite Italian when you think about it. And really nobody at the end of the day could break us apart, but it was tough going for a while.
I could tell from reading it. And before we delve into your life with your dad, I have to take a moment, Tina, and pay tribute to a person who shines through in your book so brightly. And that's your dear mother, Nancy, whom we lost in 2018. You said that although she was terribly hurt by your father's decision to end the marriage, she was incredibly strong, resilient, sensible. She never stopped loving him and giving him exactly what he needed in his life, which was constancy, adoration, total belief in him. She was a truly remarkable human being, wasn't she?
I think she was the most remarkable woman that I ever knew. I worry I didn't tell her that enough. We have to tell our parents when they're being dummies, you tell them too, but when they're not, she gave us a path to follow, put us on a path. And she lacked guile. She lacked anger that I could not find it. If it was there, it was very shielded, very guarded. She had a capacity to open and be available to anyone and everyone. We were the house she wanted to come to after school at different times in our different lives. I was this baby sibling, 4 years younger than my brother, 8 younger than my sister. So she really did raise like 2 sets of kids, because I was way, way behind the other two. So Nancy and Frankie. So my point back to mom was, she not only really did it once, she got better. So I think I might got the better of her too, the best of her. She got used to the trials and tribulations, and she, you know, did it alone. It's like Ginger Rogers with Fred Astaire. Mom did it in high heels and danced backwards, because she just had to do what she had to do.
Well, I must tell you, Tina, as a retired family court judge who saw the worst behavior imaginable by divorced parents, I'm so impressed that your parents did their best to create a positive family atmosphere even after they separated. I just want you to know, Tina, how rare that is in my experience for divorced parents to have that level of maturity.
It wasn't even maturity. There might have been a slight bargaining with mom and dad in the beginning, because it was new and the ground rules had not been set and the priority was the children. So it was decided, I'm sure, or maybe not even necessary to discuss, we will not denigrate or assume any fault on any other person other than you and me, and we don't have to share that with the kids either. But, you know, you be there and don't let me down. And when he was too far away for too long, she let him know it. I know that, because I would hear it as I got older. Remember, dad left when I was 6 months old. So I had none of the camaraderie of the family in the beginning. Somehow I feel all my life that it was maybe easier for me to lose him within the home, within the sanctuary of the family home. But before he left us, he was traveling all the time anyway. So I'd have to wait and get to know him later in our own way. And as I said, I was pretty much an only child for a lot of that period.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you immortalized your dear mom in your book by allowing us to get to know her. You should be very proud of that. And I want to mention something else that really touched me, Because as you can imagine, I read your book through the lens of a retired family court judge. I was very impressed that when you decided to go to therapy to deal with your anger stemming from your parents' divorce, your father came with you to some of those sessions, and you found that very helpful. I'm really happy that you mentioned this in your book, because it will hopefully encourage other parents to do the same. So thank you for doing that.
We were an era of, you went to a psychiatrist or psychologist, and the particular therapist I chose, and it wasn't so angry at them. It was like I was dealing with my dad better than my mother. All of a sudden, it was like if it was ever anybody's fault, it was dad. He packed the bags and left. But I found myself becoming a young woman and thinking, you know, there's two sides to this. I dragged them both in, not together. And it was very much based in the principle of the therapy and the therapist I was attending, who was attending me. And I wouldn't have given that up for anything. And they did it. It was not hard on them. Not hard at all. They just walked in with a totally objective and would sit there. Pop came once or twice. Mom came about the same amount. You know, it wasn't heavy therapy or anything weird.
It's very, very rare, I can tell you. You described your father as a man who spent his whole life looking outside for what was missing inside. What did you mean by that?
I meant very specifically that he was a man kind of always on the lookout for what's next. I think it's complicated in him, but it's always like kind of the Sammy Glick, you know, he's being a little bit chased, if you will. He would grow out of that, by the way. I think that he had the determination and the ambition in the beginning, and he did achieve it, and he achieved it quickly. And then this is what our musical really is all about. He gets silly. He gets on a wrong path, if you will. Again, that's a favorite word of mine, take the right path. And he switched paths, and it all began to crumble. What I think he would learn from losing that fine high ascendance, which happened quickly, that he could get it back and would never lose it again. So it caused him to slow down, focus, and stay where he was needed at that moment to continue to be who it was he wanted to be. And we were all in that trail. You know, we followed him. We were not first. I think I say this in the memoir. Dad's career was first. And when that was solid and secure, he was. And he could take care of everybody he loved. And he loved taking care of people he loved. So he worked damn hard, and it was for a little lack of discipline in the beginning, which he would gain and never lose again. It's pretty hard to do it once. He did it twice, if you know what I mean.
Oh, he certainly did. When I listened to your dad singing, I sense an intensity of feeling in his personality that comes out that goes far beyond the technical aspects of his voice. Do you hear that as well when you listen to him sing?
That's why a seventh, eighth, ninth generation are listening to him now. Still, he's singing to them here. They're hearing what he's thinking and feeling, and the lyrics, let's be honest, where he was surrounded by the best lyricists and composers and arrangers the world could offer. So they made magic. And it's generational because it's pure and it's honest. And I say it suits any occasion. It depends on what you're feeling.
Well, his legacy includes such a large portfolio of songs that you can find a Sinatra song to match any experience you're having in your life. I wonder, can you remember how you felt the very first time you saw your father perform on stage?
Vividly. I was seven. It was Las Vegas, which was a very strange place for a seven-year-old. I was at the stage, at the foot of the stage. It was a low stage. It was, I'm assuming I was in the Copa room at the Sands. So it was small and intimate. And I write, I sat there so proud with my nose to his toes. I was right at his patent leather Mary Janes. And I just, I knew what he did for a living. I knew that. I understood it. I heard it in on records in our home. But I hadn't seen him in the presence of other people who were glued. I can't think of the word. They were like transfixed on him. That was power of entertainment. And that was his favorite thing, by the way, was to be in front of a live audience. It's everything that he, it was a drug to him.
You were 3 years old when your parents divorced and your father married Ava Gardner, and you were 4 years old when you first met Ava Gardner. You said in your book that just because a relationship is meant to be doesn't mean it was meant to work. Based on your knowledge of your father and Ava, their personalities, do you think their relationship was doomed from the start?
I think so. I do. I definitely do think so. And, you know, it was more short-lived than I think Dad thought it should be. It was a determination that Ava came to. I think very strongly that it had to be. I think that they were going to die without each other, or that's what they thought. I cannot speak to it because I was too young to understand it, but I knew as I got older, shortly as I matured, that it was a train wreck, you know, waiting to happen, but it didn't hurt anybody. We all survived.
I understand that you maintained a friendship with Ava Gardner even after the divorce. Can you share any memories of your time with her?
I was a baby, you know, when they were divorced. So still, I barely was, I think, 7 or 8 years old, but I would grow up and move in circles. And my friends were very friendly with her. Robert Wagner knew her. I met, I think, Ava through RJ at one point in London, as a matter of fact. And I, Mia Farrow knew Ava Gardner, though they didn't quite get along. Wherever I mixed in New York or London, somehow Ava would be there, and I would, I'd grow to know her and like her. One very quick story in New York: I was just out of high school. We had an apartment at 72nd in the East River, and I called Dorothy Ullman, who you and Charlie talked a lot about. I noticed, long time assistant of Frank's, and I said, I called her Dodo. I said, Dodo, can I come in for two nights? I want to see a play and I'll leave right away. And I don't think Dad's going to be there. She said, sure, but Ava's there. I said, great. I'd met her briefly before and as a child. So off I went. We never parted company. I didn't go to the play. She didn't go where she was going. We stayed together except for walks. She wore a silk scarf, like, you know, garbo and dark glasses and a trench coat with collar. I wore the same thing. And we went walking for blocks, times of day that weren't too hectic. And I have to tell you, walking with her, every head turns to see her, but they're not sure if they're seeing who they think they're seeing. And I always read that about garbo. And then New Yorkers got accustomed to seeing beautiful older actresses because they walked in trench coats, scarves, and dark glasses. It was, and always holding my arm in arm. We got on well. And this, by the way, did not offend Mother. That just wouldn't have been the case. But it was an experience to be able to grow up and know her. I couldn't do the play that I hope gets to Broadway soon without knowing her. I wouldn't do that.
That's a very good point. You really did need to know her. And it was certainly evident in the miniseries that you found a way to reproduce her essence so that we could understand why the attraction was as strong as it was. You know, I'm going to quote you something. You said this in your book about your saddest childhood memories. Each of Dad's visits was an emotional parabola, the eager anticipating of his arrival, the giddy joy of his company, a swelling apprehension as his departure grew near, and the dull, aching void he left in his wake. We were always building up to goodbye. Tina, that's heartbreaking coming from a child. And when I read that, I was just thinking how hard it also must have been for him to say goodbye to his kids at the end of a visit, don't you think?
I think I put that forth about how difficult it must have been for him. But we did it. I can't say that it's the most vivid emotion I remember, reoccurring emotion I remember, which was goodbye. We always had to say goodbye. And then you get a driver's license and you drive to the desert. You don't have to wait for him to come to LA. You know, it all worked out, but you know, it was terribly, I mean, I knew you were going to bring that up because that quote is the most bare naked, sad thing that I can really relate to every day of my life. And I'm glad that at some point that began to fade until it became obvious of, and the inevitable would happen and we would lose him good and for all. But it was hard. But you know what? A lot of families grew up that way, I think. And you just do it.
Well, I've never heard it quite articulated the way you wrote it in the book. It's certainly a sentiment that I heard all the time in court, but you had a way of humanizing and making it relatable. And that quote really has stuck with me. I want to take a moment and pay tribute to your dear brother, Frankie, Frank Jr., whom we lost tragically and much too soon in 2016. I find it still very hard to believe that he's been gone that long.
Yeah, it's seven. Is that 7 years?
Yeah, 2024.
Mama is gone 6 years this July. So I must say my mother again, Frankie, went quickly in an afternoon far away, I think in Florida. And we just didn't know how she was going to handle it. And we were concerned that she would have a heart attack or something at that point. She was inching to 100 practically by then. She was fine with it. She did not collapse. She didn't lose herself. The shock of it and him being far away like that was really, it didn't help. And they had revived him twice. And we were saying, stop. You know, we got to tell a mother. And if you keep reviving him, we can't tell her. And we Nancy was in her driveway, a foot from the front door. I'm on the phone with Bob Finkelstein, my associate and lawyer and dear friend to all of my family. And we were just waiting for them to declare finally. It was just a bad day.
And a horrible loss. Really. You said in your book that there was a certain awkwardness or shyness or remoteness between Frankie and your dad. Why do you think that was?
Very much because of the fact Frankie was the only other male in a family of women, and not just Mom, Nancy, and me. My mother had five sisters, one brother, thank God, Uncle Bart, who attended to Frankie and attached to Frankie beautifully. He was four when Dad left home. That's a bad age. And hadn't had a great deal of time with him. And what they had was as close as father and son could be. But it was, again, building to an absentee that's got to... I think it's losing a mother at four is not good on a daughter. I just don't think Frankie could avoid it. And it was something Mom was aware of and Dad as well. But those were the years when Dad was not really as free and available as he would become as he found his footing again and success and settle down emotionally and get with, I was going to say, with a better writer woman for him, but I don't know that he did that.
You said in your book that your brother Frankie's career was a victim of bad timing and his own stubbornness. What did you mean by that?
I meant that no one forced him to wear a tuxedo and get in front of a wonderful band. Of course, he was a fine musician. He knew good music, but why would you want him to do that? I thought it was always a mistake, and he loved every minute of it. So who was I? I think he resented that I thought it was crazy of him, but I did think it was crazy. And he worked all the time with the same band. I mean, and Dad was proud of him, but I think he at times thought, you know, it's a hard business, and he's a junior. I saw them somewhere on different marquees in the same city, and I thought, that is weird.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of pressure to be the child of a legend, but when you're actually doing the same thing.
But self-imposed is what makes it nuts. I don't know. I thought, I don't know. It's something about Frankie. There was a lot about Frankie, I must say, I didn't understand.
Well, I saw him in Las Vegas in concert, and I got the feeling his style of performing was a way of being close to your dad.
Yeah.
You know, when we had Dina Martin on the show, she spoke so highly of your dad and of you. And we talked about the very special friendship between your dad, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr. What do you think those three men saw in each other that made for such a strong and loyal friendship?
Well, I think a lot of it was a real, an honest brotherhood. They were, and I also think that Sammy was a baby when Dad saw him perform. I think Dad was with Tommy Dorsey, and Will Mastin Trio was an opening act, one of many. And Dad thought, oh, I'm going to keep my eye on this kid. He loved him. And they were best buds. Sammy called Dad Butter because he kept the butter on the table. And Dean and Dad, you know, they were just two crazy kids together. And being Italian lineage, it's very that you kind of stay close to each other. By the way,
I'm so glad they had each other as such good friends and working buddies too. Now, over the years,
working and having fun, and fun and working was a big part of their joy. You know, it made it very easy. Dad always said, if you don't like what you do, quit. Not so easy for most people, but he if you didn't have fun, he said, how do you do that every day? Doing it with friends was even better.
Oh, and the chemistry between them translated on the screen so beautifully, and of course on the stage. Now, over the years, a number of actors have portrayed your dad on screen, including Ray Liotta, Philip Kasnoff, Dennis Hopper, James Russo, and others. Who do you think came closest to channeling the real Frank Sinatra?
Well, really, honestly, I would have to say, not because I cast him, but Phil Kasnoff's audition, it was a taped audition. He had this, and I compare this also to Matt Doyle, our current papa in the musical. I hate to talk about something that isn't available, but it will be. They had a swagger about him, but each of them had an individual swagger that sort of took you off your chair. So I didn't see any swagger in Ray. And Dennis, who was a friend of mine for a long time, that was just a weird, silly movie. I thought I didn't think he was right for it. And I thought it was a stinker. I don't know that I ever saw the James Russo. Did I? What was that? Was that HBO?
Yes.
I don't know. I try to, I...
Well, there's no question that Philip Kasnoff was at times jaw-dropping in his ability to channel Sinatra. I must tell you, though, that it was heartbreaking to read in your book that you don't even know for sure if your father ever saw the Sinatra miniseries that you executive produced That must be like a knife through your heart. After all the work you put into that show, why were you not able to find out if he actually watched it?
I'm certain he didn't watch it. At the time, the book I wrote in 6 months, it was out October of 2000, right? I was pretty sure. I thought I had stated it emphatically, but it was withheld from him. He had strange evil powers around him, and you can't defeat that kind of. It's a manipulation against children and about the parent. I must say, from that book, I made it clear that my stepmother and we didn't get along. We did, and then we didn't get along. And I was very worried about what I was going to write about her, because I didn't want Dad to look dumb, and I didn't want to look like the devil myself, though I had become one against her, because you fight the devil at that level. And it got so bad. But the thing is, I got more letters from stepfathers and mothers, fan letters for the book, than anything else. Stepmothers apologizing for my experience and assuring me that they not all are like that. Do you know?
I do. And I know that the experience you had is very, very common. Even on our show, we went through a very similar experience when we had Tim Conway's daughter on our show. She went through very, very much the same thing you did. I'm not going to go into Barbara deeply concerning the things that she did during those 22 years, because I want people to read the book for themselves. But I will say that someone whom I respected very much, Richard Blackwell, described Barbara as the Anne Baxter character, Eve Harrington, in All About Eve. And you said something very interesting in your book, that your father finally married his mother. What did you mean by that?
Well, Dolly and Barbara really had, they were bossy. That's what they had in common. I think a lot of my mom had a lot of Dolly in her as well. Dad needed somebody in his life at his side all the time. And it seems to me that if you were at all a bully or demanding or what's the word?
Domineering.
Domineering. Thank you. It's not that women like that are bad. It's that women like that who have bad intentions are evil. And I'd talk about Barbara from now until tomorrow and say things I couldn't even put in the book. But it's not worthy of me or your time or the listener's time, because it happens every day. It happened. My dad took Nancy and me aside that wedding day, 20 feet from where the gathering was to be, and said, "Girls, I've thought about this. I've made a decision. I think Barbara is who I will marry last time in my life to see me through the end. I think it's right for me. I hope it's good for you. Hope is good for you. Hope okay with you means look out." Dad knew exactly who she was and what she was and what she could pull. And all she was really, I don't want you to think she was conspiring to you know, hurt us, but just to void us. Was her interest was to null and void. You had him for 20, whatever, 30 plus years, me, Nancy, Frankie, longer. And now it's my turn and my son's turn. And sure enough, she did, except for the controls, get away with everything. Houses, contents. I was trying to buy gifts I'd given Dad over the years back at auction. I think Sotheby's. I have a bust here. I had to, which is heavy, big bronze bust that was should never gone to auction. It did. I got it back and then had to ship it here and pay taxes. You know, it's she was thoughtless, and her son wasn't much better, because everything ended up his and he auctioned everything away.
Well, she certainly was strategic. And if I had been with you when your father pulled you aside before the wedding, I would have said, okay, if this is what you need, it's your life, that's fine. But have you taken care of us? Are you going to protect us? Did you ever ask him that?
That would come later. It wasn't the right opportunity. I mean, the judge had walked in the house, gave it to us, this tip, 10 minutes before they stood side by side. Remember, this is a woman who would then, in years to come, annul his marriage to Mother, which is impossible. The Vatican doesn't do that, not to mention he'd have three kids who really aren't who they think they are. If the Vatican did do that, that's what it would mean. It's a very intense term, and most people thought it was true.
Well, I think that in your book, you certainly opened our eyes, because the public's vision of Barbara Sinatra publicly at every event that was televised was this doting, devoted, loving, very sweet woman. So certainly showed us what was really going on. You know, on March the 2nd, 1994, your father received a Legend Award at the Grammys. I remember that night like it was yesterday. It was really heartbreaking watching his acceptance speech. And I'm wondering, what was going through your mind during that speech?
That he shouldn't be there giving that speech, that he should not have been working the prior 2-3 years. But again, you know, she wanted him earning. I think there's a manager at the time. He was pushing from behind. They were both propping Pop up. That had a lot to do I withdrew for a year, actually, from his life, which was not hard to do. I could not watch all this anymore.
No, I can't imagine how you could have done otherwise. Your father's last movie appearance was in a TV movie that you produced called Young at Heart. He played himself in a cameo. Can you share any memories from that experience?
Well, I was lucky that he got there. My sister went to New York. I was in Toronto. Dad was in New York. The tricks that were played on me and the company and the cast and so on, a lot of people waiting one day on the miniseries set that he would be coming on a press day, and everybody would get to say hello and have pictures taken with him. He never showed up. I had to tell my cast and crew and Warner's and CBS, because, you know, everybody was gathered to meet him. Sorry, he's not coming. He doesn't feel well. In New York, we were going to screen at Radio City the miniseries. Oh, he was going to perform, I'm sorry. And we had press called, and it was just maybe a few nights before the first part of the miniseries would air. Sorry, he's in bed, he's not feeling well. I walked from the Regency Hotel down Park Avenue to the Waldorf Towers, got in that elevator, opened the door to the foyer, the beautiful floor that was Cole Porter's apartment, that beautiful checkered floor. I remember thinking, and I made a right, right into his bedroom, and I stood at his bed and said, "You're not doing this to me again. You can't do this to me. The press have come in from all over the country." It was a big night Warner and CBS had created for the big launch of this thing. He said, "I'm so sorry." He was so timid and so little. And I sat on the floor, went back to his bed, and I said, "You know what I can say about this? It won't happen again." And I got up and I left. And we went through with the night, and that was that. The point I was going to make is, if it were something important to them and he was sick, they would have got him delivered, showered and shaved and, you know, in a beautiful tuxedo, fine. It was not something they wanted, especially the wife, and I got sabotaged. So Nancy in New York gets him on a private plane that CBS and Warner sends for them to pick him and Vine up. I believe Vine, his housekeeper, came too. And we filled it with beautiful Italian cold cuts. Canada had fabulous, Toronto had great, very New York type delicatessens. And he got on and was happy and got off the plane. He was happy. He came on set. He was adorable. He met the cast and crew. The pictures are dear, and it is a fantasy film, so you're not really sure if he's there or not in the story. But because he's Olivia Dukakis, the star, gets to hug and kiss him, you know it's real and it's sweet. So he came and he went, and it worked. But Nancy went to New York to get him there because it could have been kiboshed at any time.
God bless her.
It was a tricky, dicey time.
I'm so sorry you had to go through all of that. When you look at yourself, Tina, what do you think are the most important characteristics of your own personality that you inherited from your dad?
Woo. I would say, loyalty, but that's an Italian. That runs deep in every Italian. I would say to be true to yourself and don't prejudge. Do not prejudge. I do that because the world is different. I prejudge now more than I ever did, is what I'm trying to say. It's not so easy to walk without considering who's around or what's going on. But he worried that maybe life would get tougher with him not here. And he always promised he'd never die. And believe me, I believed him. And I think he was worried, but wanted us to be strong and fair, loyal, happy.
Well, I can tell you what I think you inherited from him. Now, having had this chance to talk with you, you've inherited his intelligence. You've inherited his ability to be very focused. You've inherited his warmth. And I think you've inherited his love for his career.
Well, that's a given. I'm 76 in June coming. I did this starting around 33 with Bob Finkelstein, who was my best friend then and now. I think Dad hoped we'd get married, but he knew we could do what we have done, which is mostly the deals that are done, I don't do them. I'd say, okay, I'll think about it, explain it better. I don't know. I say no more than yes. You know, we all work very well. And our motto is, what would Frank do?
Well, you've inherited his intuition as well. What do you think is the biggest public misconception about your dad?
That he was connected to the mob. It's true. It's how he was connected and the place it held in his life. It's romanticized, I would think. I don't think anybody thought, you know, he drove a getaway car, but they do think that he had associations. That term kind of has a particular implication. He grew up with these people and he was loyal to them. They were loyal to him. They did something in the world that he didn't, you know, do. He did what he was doing. And they would meet and move through life together all the time. Is there anything hidden or illicit in that? I don't know. The FBI file was published when he died and there was nothing in there.
Well, your father was investigated and scrutinized numerous times by the Nevada Gaming Control Board, the New Jersey State Commission on Investigation, the House Select Committee on Crime, the U.S. Justice Department, and the FBI, and none of them ever uncovered a shred of illegal activity or criminal behavior. So I know this may sound a little simplistic, but I happen to think that part of the reason he was subjected to all of that harassment, because that's what it was, is because he was of Italian descent. There, I've said it.
Yeah, I think so. I think everybody has enough knowledge to know that that is the case. Something would have come of something, but nothing could stick. I went to Europe with him to avoid a Claude Pepper congressional investigation. I think, I don't remember, but it was in the early 70s. And he said, let them subpoena me. And they'll wait for me to come. He was going on holiday anyway. It was summer. And I thought, he's taken this leave of absence when he could be doing anything else because he's thumbing his nose at these people, you know, and you don't do that because they got him in anyway.
But nothing ever came of it. I've asked you.
I think he did fib a little.
Well,
he wasn't going to give them any goods. He wasn't going to comply. He just thought they were stupid. And it was always in an election year that somebody was looking for 15 minutes, you know, to shine their star. So, yeah.
Well, nothing came of it. I asked you what was the biggest misconception about your dad. Now I want to ask you, what do you think is the biggest misconception that the public has about what it's like to be the child of a major celebrity?
Gee, I don't really know that we're all stupid and spoiled. And
well, I think people think that it's very glamorous. You know, anywhere near as glamorous as people think to be the child of a big star?
I don't know. That's a question that's complicated to me because I could not be less of what you said and by choice. And I know a lot of kids. I knew many, many, and still would if I knew how to reach them, if I did social media, that they all had normal lives, hardworking. They had a work ethic imposed, I think, like we did. I think most of the women I knew had great ambition and became actors or producers or writers. I would say that I don't think the public thinks a lot about, well, not the ones my age, not anymore. Maybe they did. I don't know. Now, and I look at someone like Paris Hilton, who is my friend's daughter, and I wondered about her when she started, and I bring this up. It's important I say this. And I called her mother and said, are we sure that we got Paris on the right path here? You know, getting a lot of money for holding a handbag to go down a red carpet. I don't know. Look at Paris Hilton. She was as intelligent then as she is now. She's doing wonderful work for her very personal cause. Her family, Rick and Kathy, her dad and mom, are handling it well, and they're doing so much good. I think we all grow up to be decent people. What they think of us when we're flighty and teenagey, I don't know. I wonder what those kids today are thinking too, now that you bring it up.
You mentioned earlier in the interview that your father was renowned for his generosity over the years. He raised over $1 billion performing benefit concerts. He helped countless people who were in need, almost always anonymously. Where do you think that generosity in his personality came from?
Oh, I think he was always that way. I think that it gave him the anonymous part of that gave him the privacy to do what he could do because he wanted to do it. If it had to be public that he kept doing it, it wouldn't have been the same for him. He doesn't like that. The days, many times I would sit watching TV waiting for dinner in the desert or wherever we were, and he'd hear something on the news and he'd make a call to the accountant and say, we're in Chicago, family fire, trees and packages burn, nowhere to sleep, click. And that was that. And you knew that they were going to have a Christmas morning somewhere.
What an incredible man. Now, you're a senior board member of Frank Sinatra Enterprises. Part of your job is to authorize the licensing of your father's name, likeness, and recordings. I want to get your reaction to two of my all-time favorite Frank Sinatra merchandise items, the Frank Sinatra Neckwear Collection, which, for people who may not know, it's a set of beautiful silk ties with designs from Frank Sinatra's abstract paintings. And there's also a terrific coffee table book featuring his paintings called A Man and His Art. Don't you just love those two things?
Well, I certainly do. I did the foreword for the book. Once we had done the book, we met a tie manufacturer and I sent him the book. He wanted to do something. And sadly, We got many, but they're wider now than ties are. But trust me, Harvey, you're going to get some. And I went through the book with him, and I named the paintings, I believe, in the book. So the ties have the same name as the paintings. We had more ties than there were pieces in the book. And they're well cased in a storage area, and we only have about 1,000 of them or more left. But
please save me one.
I'm going to send you 3. I'm thinking.
Oh, Dean, I so appreciate that.
No, my pleasure.
So when you hear your dad's voice, or you watch one of his movies or concert performances on TV, what goes through your mind?
Well, it washes through. It's just him. And I'll think of something, you know. It's when he was first gone from us, everything was all Frank. And that gave me tremendous, it was embracing for me. Nancy couldn't look at him or hear him. I couldn't hear him enough and see him enough. It was just a different attitude. But it's always fun when you're somewhere and you hear him over the dim of the dinner chatter, and somebody else does too. And I look at them and they're looking at me to see if I respond to it. And I don't. I just sort of say hi to Dad. I'm thinking of him in the moment.
I'm glad that brings you some comfort to know that the whole world still loves him so much. I want to take you back to May 13th, 2008, when the United States Postal Service launched the Frank Sinatra postage stamp. That must have been a very, very special day for you and your family.
It was a special day, but not as special as the 3 years earlier when we got the call that they wanted to do Frank as a stamp. It was like, we wondered about this. It was 10 years later, but it was 3 years minus. You can't be a stamp for 10 years or something like that. The sad part of it was for me was that it wasn't going to be a forever stamp. They hadn't done those yet in any of them. We were going to be a stamp, and we had a wonderful artist do a rendering. And it took about a year. And the postmaster, I just got his book on stamps. I wish I could hold it up to you. He just published it. He brought it with him. They came to see us once. Then they came back with the artwork, and we sort of, we didn't grimace, but it was not perfect. And they didn't think so either. It was 3 lovely people from U.S. Postal Service come to us to talk about if we liked the artwork or not. It was like dying and going to heaven. I could hand it to Dad. I was so excited. Finally, we got the artwork right. And it was the day launch Las Vegas was where I went. Nancy and Frankie were in New York on the morning on NBC morning. Good morning, whatever it's called. And I was in Las Vegas, and it was a simultaneous rollout across the country of these stamps. And where I was, where Nancy and Frankie would come to join me in Las Vegas, all of the marquees went to the stamp. So when you went up and down the strip, every marquee you saw was the stamp.
Well, I want everyone to know that the U.S. Postal Service produced 120 million Frank Sinatra stamps. They were completely sold out in under 3 weeks, which is just amazing. So tell us, what's happening with Sinatra the Musical? Is the show coming to Broadway?
Well, I say we're inching there. Yeah. You know, there are a lot of plays ahead of us. There's kind of, you get on a long line. Once they start opening, which they are now, this season is coming up, we'll see what succeeds and what doesn't. Wishing everybody well, but the fewer successes, the more you move up. And we are talking to one of the most renowned theaters on Broadway, and he's got to go to Broadway. West End is too busy, and we'll get there someday. They just have no real estate, really.
My dream is to see Sinatra the Musical on Broadway with you.
Me too, Harvey. You will sit side by side. I think it's going to happen certainly no later than fall of 25 and could be sooner.
I want to be your date.
Okay.
Now, I recently read that Martin Scorsese wants to make a Frank Sinatra biopic. How do you feel about that?
He's wanted to do it since I met him 20 years ago, and we danced around it for a while, but the scripts just were not right. I'll tell anybody everything there is to tell, but you cannot manipulate truth and then change the character of Frank Sinatra. I will not allow that. So people think I'm not willing to part with truth. That's not true. I just won't corrupt a character that was not capable of some of the things that get written about him. And Marty, who I admire, love, and adore, knows, though he's got discouraged and said, I think Tina is holding too tight a grip. I don't hold a grip. I don't hold anything back. But Marty does believe that I know if I read a script I liked, I'm there. I mean, we'd all be there.
And well, you proved it because you did issue a miniseries that you executive produced. So you clearly are prepared to allow a biopic if you agree that the script reflects the truth.
Well, but that was network commercial television 30 years ago. The rights just reverted back to us, by the way, from Warner Brothers Television. But the point with Marty is Marty's going to make a Marty Scorsese film. And I think that writers want to give Marty what they think Marty wants. Marty doesn't as much develop in the beginning as people think he does. He'll look at a script when it's written. I'll look at it at the same time with him. He will say, what did Tina feel about it? Or Tina, what did you think? And every time it happened, I said, Marty, it's not real. It's just, I mean, license is one thing, but changing a character's character is not fair. And when that happens, I have a problem.
Are you okay with Leonardo DiCaprio playing your dad?
He's talented. I think it is, by the way, about Frank and Ava. It is our play because the original writer of our musical wrote the script that Marty bought. I don't think he's the writer on the future film anymore, but it stems from the musical. I'm not offended by that. I did not like that script, obviously, or the writer would have stayed on. But is Leonardo right for it? I have to say, he's an actor. He can do anything. Our cast, our Matt and Phoebe, who plays Mama and Anna, they're the appropriate age. Yeah, I think I don't know that it matters. I don't know, Harvey. It's Marty's picture.
Well, I know one thing.
We haven't read it yet either, by the way. When he's ready, he's going to send it. And you can't.
Well, everybody's very anxious to know about it. But I know one thing, knowing you, it's not going to get made unless you're satisfied that it reflects the truth. And I think all of us Sinatra fans really respect you for that. Well, Tina, I have only one more question for you, and it's this. I know you believe in destiny. You're a very spiritual person. You said in your book that in our souls, we all choose our parents. So my question to you is, have you been able to figure out why your soul chose the parents you had?
I do believe we pick our parents. I do believe that. And it's knowing my family and thinking of them in juxtapositions, because I think we continue. We just never get out of we're in that family box, but we are not. I'm not a kid next time. I'm the aunt that saved Frank's life at birth. I don't know. I just feel that we have spiritual connections that don't dissolve. If we come back, I believe we stick with who we know. I don't feel like I had met them the first time in this life of mine. I feel like I know them longer because I understood them too well too soon, or thought I did, and I was right. They seem familiar to me. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. It's a question of understanding their spirit and knowing the connection you have is much deeper than chronologically it is on this earth.
And this pass, I hope we can do it, a little differently based on who we are when we meet again. I'd be happy to just know I'm going to see them again. That's what I want.
I don't want it to be too soon, though, Tina, please.
Okay. Well, they can come. They can visit.
It's been an enormous privilege having this opportunity to talk with you and to pay tribute to everything you've been doing to keep Frank Sinatra's artistry and body of work and legacy alive. I know you don't give many interviews, and I want to thank you so much from my heart for taking this time to appear on our show. Thank you, Tina.
Thank you, Harvey, and you're my date at the musical on Broadway, okay?
I am so there, and I want to wear a Frank Sinatra tie.
Okay.
Our guest has been the wonderful Tina Sinatra, daughter of the legendary Frank Sinatra. Her book, My Father's Daughter, a memoir, is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. Make sure you get the 2015 edition, which is in honor of Frank Sinatra's 100th birthday. For more information about Frank Sinatra and all of the exciting projects coming out from Frank Sinatra Enterprises, please go to the official website, sinatra.com. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy. But being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care. And BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today to get 10% off your first month.